nose to the trail, tail on the point, you know. And I would find him, and he would be with a lower companion. And that would irritate me, so I'd find it necessary to slap her flat, turn the table upside down, throw a drink in his face, and I would pulverize him. And the bouncer would throw me out. Now, I haven't had a drink at all. He hasn't been barred from any bar. I've been barred from several bars and two pawn shops. He would always pawn my stuff, not his, because he didn't have anything. It was all mine. Everything was all mine, you know. And so I would get into these little troubles, you know. I've been attacked by a washing machine. I don't know how many of y'all have been attacked by your washing machine, but I was. I had these freak accidents that would happen to me. I had an old Frigidaire washing machine, and I think a drunk designed it. When it would go into spin, see, the agitator didn't go back and forth. It went up and down. It really cleaned your clothes well, but when it went into spin, it would tie them in knots, and it would go off balance. It even had a button on the front that said, reset. It knew it was going to go crazy. So my mother, like I say, my mother worked at home. She was a dressmaker, and my mother prided herself in making clothes that would not come apart, ever. And so she'd made a denim dress. Remember when we used to wear sack dresses? Some of the ladies here are old enough. Remember those? The long, and had long ties in front. And so I had this denim dress, had these long ties, and I'm in there trying to get my clothes untied, and I didn't realize my ties had flipped in. Now, I'm here to tell you, wet clothes grab. And this did not have the safety mechanism that when the lid is up, it won't go, because it would. And so when I punched the reset button, I went down into the washing machine. It grabbed those ties, and I went down, and my head was on that agitator. I went through 16 minutes of drip dry. At the end of which, I didn't have a tooth in my head that wasn't loose. My jaws were black and blue, but it was all his fault. You see, if he'd have been home like he should have been, I wouldn't have been worrying about him when I was doing all this. I would have noticed that, so it wasn't my fault. You know, that's kind of crap, you know. That's great sanity there, you know. But the greatest insanity is doing the same stuff again and again and again that doesn't work, and keep going back to the problem and it doesn't work. You know, I'm a good cook, and I would not make a recipe over and over again, leaving the same ingredient out every time and making something flop and not do it that way again. I mean, I just can't imagine why I would do my life like that, but I did. And sanity doesn't necessarily instantly return the minute you walk through the doors of Al-Anon, you know. It takes a while. You know, I still had an anger problem. And my sister, we were doing some stuff work over at her house, and I had done some prior to that at my house, and I had used some spackling compound that was pre-mixed in a bucket. And so when we got ready to do hers, I said, oh, that's so much better than having to take that powder and mix it up and everything. I said, well, get the bready mixed. And so we went over. I called, and the store said they had it, and we got over there, and they didn't have it. So we went into a Sears store, and I should have known better. I've never had good experiences at Sears Roebuck. They have wonderful products. I'd keep going back for wonderful products, but I just couldn't seem to get service with my products. If I ordered something red and white, it would come yellow and brown. It didn't make any difference. You know, if I ordered something king size for the bed, it would come twin size. I don't know why, but it just seemed to be, it's not a good place for you. But I couldn't accept that. And so I went to Sears, and I had called them ahead of time, explained to them in great detail. You know how we are. We explain in great detail. And I told them I did not want the kind with the powder that you mix. I wanted the pre-mixed. Oh, yes, we have it. I drove all the way across, and it was like about 18 miles across two cities to get to the Sears store. And the guy hands me the box of powder. And I said, what is this? And he says, well, that's the compound you wanted. And I said, I told you I wanted it premixed. He said, well, this is just the same. You just take some water and what? No, it is not the same. And I said, how could you? How could you lie to me like that? Just lied to me. When I asked you point blank and you lied to me. And I was just, I wanted to hit him. And I knew if I did, I'd go to jail. And so, but I had to do something. And so he's right next to the garden department. I ran over there. I grabbed a philodendron and I went. And I just bit that philodendron all the way up and down the vine. And my sister is going. And the guy backs up now. And I said, let's get out of here. And so we left. And my sister said, I've never seen anything quite like that. And I told her, I said, well, this is nothing. Trust me. And so I was, you know, you have to confess to your sponsor. So I was telling her, and she's going, you didn't. Yeah, I did. And she said, well, you're going to have to go back and make an amends. To a philodendron? She said, that was not right. She said, who wants to buy a bit philodendron? Oh, God. So, okay, the next week I'm back over there. The philodendron still had the little tooth prints in the leaves. I went over there, I bought the philodendron, and I'm walking past the guy in the paint department, and he's backing up. And I said, I'd like to apologize for my inappropriate behavior. I lost my temper. And he said, I guess I really shouldn't have told you to come and get powder. I said to myself, no, asshole, you shouldn't. And I said, thank you for that. And I walked out. You see, you can say a lot in your mind if you just don't get it out. Your insanity can come back upon you at any time. You know, your insanity can come back. And a lot of times for me, it's in stressful situations when the insanity comes back upon me, you know. A few years ago, one of the girls I sponsored called me, and she says, let's meet down in Dallas at the airport. And she says, let's go to the Four Seasons in Las Colinas and spend the weekend in the spa. I said, gosh, that sounds good. And she said, be my treat for Christmas. And I said, that sounds even better. And so I met her down there, and I'm in this great big fancy spa. I mean, we have spas in Arkansas and what have you, but this not like there. And I mean, there were movie stars going in that spa and the kind of stuff. And I'm just, you know, I'm just looking at all this. And so the first thing, though, it's traumatic. It's traumatic when you think about when you're a big woman and you think about undressing and putting on these robes. And I'm looking for a dressing room for they tell you put your clothes in the locker and there's no dressing room. And I'm going, well, where do you take off your clothes? And they said, well, right there. And I go, oh my God, out in front of God and everybody. And they said, yeah, you know, everybody has the same. I said, well, maybe not as much, you know. And so finally we get out and get in this big fluffy robe, and we go to what I refer to as the holding tank. And this is where you go in and wait until they call you to come for whatever procedure. And they have a giant hot tub that looks like the size of a swimming pool, and then a cold tub, another one on the other side. And there's all these women that are just going over there and taking off their little thing and jumping in the hot tub naked as a pig bird. And I ain't got my magazine. I'm going, oh God, oh God. I'm old-fashioned, oh, God, you know. And then they get out of there, and they get in the cold tank, and I'm just, oh, God, I'm seeing more flesh than I ever wanted to see. And if you think I'm getting in there, you're not going to. I will refuse to be harpooned. I refuse. And so then they call my name, and they say, you know, come in. The girl's walking down the hall with me, and she said, and Tim will be your Tim? Now, I've always had a woman masseuse, you know. Tim? Oh, I don't think so. Tim? And about that time, here's this very attractive young man, probably in his mid-20s, in his little bitty short shorts and his tan, and he says, I'm Tim. And I'm going, oh, Jesus. I can't do this. And he says, if you'll just lay there, and he says, with your face down, and I'll be back in a few minutes. And I'm going, oh, God, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. Oh, he'll tell everybody he did Moby Dick. I know he will. I know he will. So anyway, I'm there laying my face, and I decided to pray for everybody I know. Take your mind off of it. Pray for everybody you know. I'm praying away. I'm praying away. And it's beginning to feel good, you know, and he's getting down to my lower back, and I'm thinking, oh, God, this is good. And then your brain just goes against you. And your brain says, now, whatever you do now, don't fart. Where does that come from? And Tim says, oh, you got all stiff again. My mind says, stiff, stiff. You don't even know what stiff is. You couldn't send a straw up my butt with a sledgehammer. I am stiff. If I can just live through this massage, you know. All in all, it was a great experience. It was a nice experience that weekend. But that's what I'm saying, your mind, you can go insane at any moment in time, you know. Step 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. That's the God that you understand, not a God of somebody else's understanding. It doesn't, if you were in a formal religion, it doesn't have to be that. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. It's the God that you can understand. And I remember the first speaker that I ever heard at a conference. Her name was Ramona Belford, and she was an Indian girl from Oklahoma. And her spirit, her higher power was the Great Spirit. And she said, I would give you my higher power. But if I did, I would take away the joy of you developing that for yourself. And I thought, that's okay. I'll take yours. You know. I don't need joy. You know, but that's the truth, you know. And the thing about it is, remember at this step, you're only being asked to make a decision. It doesn't say you turn your will and your life over, because how do you do that? I don't know. How do you do that? I don't know. How do you find out? By working the rest of the steps. All you have to decide here is, are you going to do it on your own from now on, like you've been doing, or are you going to ask a power greater than you to give you guidance and direction? Are you going to do it different here? That's all it's about. It's just making a decision to do it another way. Do it another way. And, you know, I found that it's amazing. When I decided I would take the third step prayer, and I took it, and I was like maybe 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. JD was working. He would get home around 4. And I was sitting there, and I thought, okay, God, I'm ready. I am ready to turn my will in my life. That's my thoughts and my actions. I'm going to run stuff past you instead of just going off on automatic. I'm going to really try. I can see you've been working in my life, but now I want to make a conscious decision to turn my will in my life over to you. And are you ready to get it? I need a sign. I need something to know that it's okay. And so I sat there and I got on my knees and I did the third step prayer, and nothing happened. I knew it. God don't want my will in my life. I figured it would come down to this. Maybe you're not looking in the right place. So I go rummaging over in a closet, and I go down in the bottom, and I pick up that Bible that I'd had when I was a little kid. And I brought it back, and I said, I'm going to open it up, and God's going to say, okay. I opened it up. Don't mean a thing. Best 2 out of 3. Open it up. You know, nothing's happening. And so I just set it over there on top of the end table. And I'm so discouraged. And JD comes in. I said, well, I tried to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, but he doesn't want it. JD said, really? I said, yeah. And he said, honey, I don't. And I said, don't argue with me. This is my will, my God. He said, okay. So the next morning I get up. Now, what do you do? What do you do? Well, my sponsor had told me in the mornings all I need to do is say please. And that could be my prayer for the start of my day and end it with thank you. That's simple enough. Well, all I know to do is what I've been doing. So I say please and I reach over for my ODAP book. And my ODAP book is underneath the Bible where I had laid it on top of the end table. And I snatch my ODAP out from under that Bible lest it be contaminated. And I did my reading for the day. And then I thought, okay, and the Bible fell in the floor. And so I thought, okay, I'll go and I'll put that back in the bottom of the box over there where it was. And I don't know why, but I just happened to glance down because it had fell open. And it said, be still and know that I am God. You know, so God did answer. God answers in his time and in his way, not necessarily on demand. And I knew, as one of the girls I sponsor says, down deep in your knower, you know deep down inside where you know all things. And so I found that, you know, it says turn your will and your life over the care of God, a loving God, not a punishing God, not a fearsome God, you know, a loving God, because God loves you and cares. God cannot hate that he creates, you know. And God knows you better than anybody else. And the funny thing is, the closer you spend time with God, the more you know about you. Because if you want to know how something ticks, get with the person who made it. You know, because God knows you and understands you. Now, I had lots of religious training as a child, but like I said, I didn't develop a relationship. And I found out that God doesn't hold grudges. And God doesn't, he's not into a lot of stuff that everybody gives him credit for, you know. God has a sense of humor. And I was talking to my sponsor, and I said, you know, if I could make God, this is how I'd make God. And I told her he would have a sense of humor. He would be very forgiving. He would always be loving. He would always be there. Always be there. No matter what I did, no matter if I screwed up or not, God would still love me. He wouldn't quit loving me. And she said, that's the way your higher power can be. She said, your God can be any way that you need your God to be. You know, and if anything touches me in any area of my life, God cares. God cares about those things. And she says, God can be all those things. And she says, God brings good, orderly directions, the G-O-D, good, orderly directions into your life each day. And if you follow those, it's okay. And I said, well, how do you know if you're doing God's will? She says, well, you know when you're not doing God's will. So you're halfway there. She says, if you don't do the things you know you're not supposed to do, chances are you might be doing something you should be doing, you know. And so that was how we started that journey. And she says, did you know whatever you think about the most becomes your higher power for that moment in time? If you're focusing on another person, they become your higher power because what they're doing and not doing is affecting how you're doing and not doing, feeling, whatever. So she says, you know, just be sure and let God be God. And don't put God in a box. Don't limit God on how he can do things. Just like the putting the money in the pants pocket. You know, when my sister was in the hospital, she had to have heart surgery in 95. I'd been spending a lot of money and a lot of time staying over at the hospital with her because she also had blood clots in her lungs after the surgery, so she didn't get to come home for a month, and that was a lot of extra expense from where I live back and forth every day. And I thought, oh, it's time for our annual yard party, and oh gosh, I'm running a little short. I don't know if I'm going to have the money to be able to do that or not. And then I went to the post office. It was raining. I got out of the car, and I saw this dollar bill laying down there in the water. And it was folded, and I picked it up and threw it in the car and went on in the post office and mailed the stuff. Got back later in the day. I thought, oh, I need to unwind it so it'll dry. And it was a $100 bill. See, I would never tell God to put it in a puddle in front of the post office. So don't limit God on how he brings things to you, you know. And another thing, I had to trust God. Now, trusting God was a whole different thing. You can believe in God, but do you trust God? You see, a lot of times I had given God credit for doing bad things to me. I'd say God was the giant zapper. You know, you'll be going along, and all of a sudden you get zapped, you know. Because what happened is I would have to accept the consequences of my actions. I call that zapping, you know. And that was just the natural consequence to have to take for the actions I had been taking. And so I had to learn to give God another chance. And so I had to forgive God for all those things I had blamed him for and ask him to forgive me for judging. And that cleared up that relationship for me. And God, following God's will doesn't just mean drifting along with the tide. You got to have a conscious, wholehearted bending of your will to merge with God's will, you know. And the acid test is it working? If it's not working, then you're not doing your part, because God always does his. And if your God, you know, is not big enough, then get you a bigger God. You know, for a lot of times, people would say to me, well, when do you run, you know, what if you, God has a quota on things he'll do for you? I said, well, I think that's limiting God. I don't think God has a quota. I haven't got a quota on how many times I can screw up. You know, it just happens. You know, you should wake up and there it is. And in order to have a God, you got to quit being God, you know. And they had a big sign in the Serenity House that says, today there's only one God, and you're not him. And, you know, that's the truth, because those are the kind of things that I would get into doing, playing God or making decisions based on my will. And I was told to practice the presence of God in my life on a daily basis. And that is when you wake up in the morning, you know, it's like, God, here we go. Go with me this day. And my sponsor for a long time had me do mirror talk. And that's where I'd get up and I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, good morning, God. Nothing's going to happen to me today that we can't get through together. Love God. You know, I'd do that, and I'd say, but that's me looking. She said, it says that God is you're made in God's image, so if you're looking at you're looking at God. Because God is inside of each and every one. You know, we search for God everywhere. God's not lost, you know. He's right inside. What a sneaky place to hide. You know, we have a tendency to look out there. But, you know, the problem in with me is I have a spiritual hole. And that spiritual hole cannot be filled by things outside. I tried that for years. Haven't you ever said, whenever I get this, whenever I do that, whenever this happens, everything will be okay? And then you get that, do that, or get that, and guess what? It's still not okay, because it hasn't filled that spiritual hole. And all that stuff out there is not really important. Once the spiritual hole is filled, you're okay. Whether all that stuff is okay or not, you're okay. So it's better to be okay than to worry about the other. And that, you know, there's two prayers too that is like, God, help me to let you work in my life today. Help me stay out of your way, and don't let me push you aside. Because so many times we push God aside. I think I got a better plan, you know. Or it doesn't look like God's working on it. See, that's the thing. When you're not getting the results you think there ought to be happening, it's like God's not working on it. Well, God is working on it, whether it looks like it or not, you know. Because there's no spot where God is not, you know. And so I've learned in the bless it, block it. I'll say, God, here's what I think I need to do. Either bless it or block it. I'm okay either way. I want to do what you want me to do. If it's supposed to be, then bless it and let it go. And God, when you're blocking it, when you shut the door, help me to recognize a closed door before I beat my head flat. You know, you'd be surprised how many times you'll run your head into the door thinking, you know, this is what you're supposed to be doing. Because, you know, we've got problems. We have problems with selfishness. How's it going to affect me? And then self-seeking, what's in it for me? And then the worst one, self-centeredness. It's all about me. You know, those are the things that block us, you know. And you got to use God for the little things. You know, I always feel like the big things in life, we can do those pretty good. Bad or good, we can get through those. But it's those everyday little fleas and ticks that drive you nuts. It's those little annoying things, you know. It's like my husband, he's a pack rat, and he doesn't have a place for anything. So whenever he's through with it, there is its place. And whereas I'm organized and I have a place and I want things to be in their place. And so I live with a man who's just the opposite. Why do we do that? Why do we pick idiots that are so different from us? Because they're exciting. And because we love them, you know. And so I have to accept less than perfection. You know, if I don't, it'll drive me crazy. So when I see stuff laying out, I say to myself, how important is it? Is it worth bad feelings to him? Is it worth making him feel less than to point out his defect today? Is it worth that today? Some days when I'm in a pissy mood, yeah, it's worth it. That's what we have in a men's step about. You know? But you just got to trust. You got to trust God to bring those things. We have had lots of instances of things when you just have to turn it over and then accept what happens. What happens is God's will, or it wouldn't be happening. You know, it has to be. And sometimes it's like the situation with my sister and her health situation, I had to keep saying, I trust you, God, I trust you, God, I trust you, God, I trust you, God, I trust you, God. I have to just make that a mantra and keep saying it all the time. And then I'd say, I don't really trust you, but I'm going to say this until I can. Thank you. I trust you, God, I trust you, God, because it's like I didn't like what was happening. I didn't like the way it was. And I'm always telling my husband about stuff. I'll say, just get a grip here, boy. And you know what? I found out you get the best grip when you learn to let go. That's when you really get the grip, when God comes in. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. The main reason I had such a hard time with this step is I saw 5. Sort of like Family Feud. They shouldn't reveal them to you, you know, until after you've done it. Because when it says you're going to have to admit it to God, yourself, and another person, I didn't want to have to tell another person the stuff that I knew. I had so much guilt and so much shame. I kept thinking, why do you have to do it with somebody else? Why would you have to go and talk to somebody else about something like that? You know, it's very important that we do that. But we'll get to that in 5. Because I had all these fears and guilts and shame about my past behavior. And I hated for anyone to know my great truth. I hated my mother. You know, kids are not supposed to hate their mothers. That's sort of un-American. It may be un-Canadian too. I don't know. You know, but you're supposed to love your mother. It seems that everybody says that. And I hated my mother. And why did I hate my mother? Because my mother didn't love me. And it's like, if you're not going to love me, I'm not going to love you. And besides, I'm going to hate you for not loving me. And I fed on that hate and the stuff. And you see what I was doing as a child, I am confusing approval with love. And when my mother would correct me and disapprove of something, to me it said, I don't love you. I don't love you. When she was not saying, I don't love you. But the fact she didn't say, I do love you, made me feel that way. And so I didn't love her. I hated her. When my first marriage, I had been an adulterous wife. I had failed miserably in marriage. I was unable to be a mother. I felt like that God was punishing me for being a bad wife by making me sterile so I couldn't have children. And so I just said, well, if I can't, then I have freedom to do anything and anyone I want to. And so I didn't like having to go back and look at that kind of stuff. That made me feel bad, made me feel dirty. I wanted to do somebody else's inventory. That's always more fun, isn't it? So the first inventory that I took in the program was that of my grand sponsor. I didn't like her at all. I really didn't like Ethel at all. And we do have a sponsorship family in my line of sponsorship. And so I was always taught to respect, you know, and it would be real hard because I just didn't like her. She was sort of a know-it-all. And she was very frank, very blunt. You're laughing. So every time I'd go to the meeting, I made a list, and I had a piece of paper, things I hate about Ethel. And I would write something down at every meeting, something I hated about Ethel. And then one night, J.D. Saw me. I was over there looking at my list because we were going to meeting, and I didn't want to duplicate anything, so I was checking it out. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I have this list of crap I hate about Ethel." And he says, "Well, in AA, don't you hate it when they start off like that? In AA, they tell us that there's good in the best of and the worst of us, and there's bad in the best of us. So there must be something good about Ethel. There's no good about Ethel. I am not wrong." And he said, "Well, have you ever looked?" I ain't gonna tell him. But no, I haven't. So that night I go to the meeting and I'm going to try and see if there is any good in Ethel. And so we're talking about anger and what have you. And she said that whenever she gets really, really irked about something or real anger, that she had a lot of problems with anger, that she would repot plants. Because that getting down in the dirt, she could kill him and she could do this and that. And she could plant him like she was burying him in the... And she said she had done that so many times, she'd worn the roots off some of her plants. So I turned my piece of paper over and I wrote things I like about Ethel. Ethel likes plants. It was a start. So now it became a challenge. And so then it was real funny because after a few weeks, I got to looking on both sides and I had about the same amount of stuff on both sides. So you see, there was a lot of good about Ethel. But the terrifying thing was, as I'm sitting there reading it back and forth, I had this terrible awakening. I said, "Oh my God, I know why I don't like Ethel." And JD said, "Why?" And I said, "I think we're just alike." And see, I didn't like me, so therefore I didn't like Ethel. I had found another Mary Pearl. And so I went to my sponsor and I showed her this list. She said, "How long you been doing this?" "That's not important." And she read it and I said, "I think I'm like Ethel." Oh, she said, "Oh, hell yes, you are. We all knew that." I said, "You're kidding me." She said, "No." I said, "Why didn't you say?" She said, "You couldn't have stood it." She said, "God let you know when you were able to stand it." And so I found out I could like Ethel. And I come to love Ethel as I come to like me and learn to love me. You know, it was the things in her. Because see, the things you see in other people, you hate the worst. You have those same things within yourself, if you'll be honest about it, you know. So if you're having a hard time taking your inventory, take somebody else's and then mark their name off. Put yours up there. Sort of an inventory shortcut. I had so much self-righteousness. I just didn't realize that. Because, see, things were never my fault. Never my fault. And the accurate inventory was when I found out that I had a lot of work to do in the area of relationships, finances, honesty. I didn't know the difference between a want and a need. I could see something once or twice, say, "Gosh, that's pretty. Boy, I'd like to have that. I need that." I could do it just that quick. And I mean in less than, you know, 30 seconds, I could go from one to the other. I was talking with a girl on the phone that I sponsored one day, and she had to go to the door. Someone rang the doorbell. She was gone maybe a half a minute, maybe. And I'm on the phone there, and I'm holding, and I'm thinking, "Oh, I'm hungry. I'd like some breakfast. What would you like for breakfast?" "Oh, I'd really like a bacon and tomato sandwich for breakfast." "But you can't fix bacon." "I know. I just cleaned my stove." "Once you cleaned it, you don't ever want to cook on it again." "What you need is a microwave, because then you could put that bacon on that paper in a microwave, and then it wouldn't spatter on your stove, and then you could have a bacon and tomato sandwich." "That's right. That's exactly what you need." In 30 seconds, I went from, I want a bacon and tomato sandwich to, I need a microwave. So when she came back to the phone, I said, thank God you're back. I just bought a microwave. She said, what? I said, eh, you know. But that's how fast my mind works, you know. I demanded a lot of attention from people because I saw attention as love. You see, all my life I've been in this search for love. And when you don't love you, you really don't trust love from other people. You know, you got to be able to do something. Anything you want for someone else to give you, you got to be willing to give it to somebody else. And I didn't know how to love. I didn't know how. And yet I wanted you to love me enough to make up for both of us. That kind of thing. And I was full of emotional insecurity. I don't know if y'all were, but it says that the common symptoms of emotional insecurity are worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. There it is. And it's from our twisted relationships that many of us have suffered the most, you know. And I did have those twisted relationships because I'm a real stubborn, real strong-willed person. Of course, I know y'all don't believe that. I had the inability to form a true partnership with another human being. I had to be better than you or less than you. I didn't know how to be a partner with you. I just didn't know how to do that. And yet we struggle to try to get to the top of the heap, always struggling, trying to get to the top of the heap. And the truth of the matter was, you could be there and wouldn't know you were there. You know, I was an overachiever in school. I was the kind of kid, I made not just straight A's, I made straight A pluses. I was the class valedictorian of 640 kids. I had to be that in order to feel as good as the kid that brought home a C. I had to be that way in order to feel that. There's nothing. How many secrets do you keep? Remember, you're only as sick as their secrets. And I was always having to keep those things secret, the things that I'd do or the feelings I'd have, because if I was to tell you those thoughts or those feelings, then you wouldn't like me. And you know why? I didn't like me. I had them, and I was holding them, and I didn't like me, so I knew you wouldn't. And we always had that fear of rejection, it seems like. Our fear of abandonment, that people are going to leave you. Well, you know, I love my dad, and he left when I was 12. Couldn't get rid of mother. You know, that kind of thing. And you hear people come in, and they'll say, don't you see my case is different? Well, if your case is different, you might as well go on out the door, because we have nothing for you. It's our sameness that makes what we do work. So when you go into a meeting, try not to find out what is different between you and everybody else, but what is the same? What is the common denominator? What do you have in common, you know? And when I started my first four-step, I did the Blueprint for Progress. How many people here have used that? Did you get a lot of relief out of that? I didn't. In fact, one day I was telling a lady that was in the car with me, they'd picked us both up at the airport, she was a speaker also. I said, you know, of all of our literature, the Blueprint for Progress seems to be the most inadequate piece of garbage for what it's intended to do of any literature we have. And she said, well, thank you, I wrote it. And I said, really? And she said, you might be interested to know that when I wrote it, I had never done one. And I told her, I said, well, it absolutely didn't do a thing for me because it did not address the areas. It did not ask the questions. I said, you know, I'm the kind of person, you have to nail me. You know, you can't pussyfoot and be nice about asking something. You've got to be blunt and ask me point blank and nail me to the wall before you're going to get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Because those things that I need to say, because of the guilt and the shame and what have you, I'll have a tendency to minimize or walk around it. But if you nail me, then I'll tell you. And my sponsor was really good. You know, I find that the best thing about sponsorship is you don't have to know the answers at all, but you've got to know the questions to ask to get them to see their own answer. And I've always been good at the why questions. And so the purpose of this inventory is not just to see what is good and bad in a person, but what is the truth? What is the truth of a person? You see, because I'd had an affair when I was married the first time, I put a label on myself. It said whore. I wasn't a whore. I never got paid. I didn't go out and stand on a street corner, and even if I had, what the heck, you know? But the bottom line, it was how I felt about me for what I'd done. It had nothing to do with what I'd done, but how I felt about me for what I had done. You know, the lady that I did my fifth step with told me, she said she was a very religious woman, and I thought, oh, she's really gonna not like all this. And she said, you know, you haven't done anything I haven't done or thought about doing. And she said, and in my faith, to think about it is the same as having done it. And I thought, boy, I'm glad I don't have your faith. But for her to feel as guilty as I felt, you know, I mean, it just never occurred to me that a person could feel that guilty and not having done this stuff. Because me, if you're going to carry the name, you might as well play the game, you know. But what was the truth of MERP, you know? And I was really confused. And one of the first things that I saw when I was doing, what I did then was I asked my sponsor's husband, who ran a treatment facility there, a halfway house. I asked him, I said, what do the alcoholics use as an inventory guide? Surely it's something more meaty than this. And he said, yes, and he handed me this 13-page inventory. And he said, this is what they do. But he says, this is going to apply a lot to drinking. And I said, well, I can change it to thinking. Because drinking and thinking, what is the difference? You know, other than an allergy to alcohol, what is the difference between the alcoholic and the Al-Anon? I have obsessions. I have compulsions. I just don't drink. I'm not allergic to alcohol, but I am allergic to alcoholics sometimes. My behavior gets weird when I get around them. You can't predict my behavior. I mean, I have other things going. So once they're sober, what's the difference? What's the difference? And so that was what I was doing. And so I began to work on that inventory. And it addressed all of those things, the financial things, the sexual things. It addressed all those feelings of guilt and what have you. And it also asked for some good things, you know. And I'm trying to think of what good things. And so I wrote down the following. When I was 5 years old, Daddy and I decided to go fishing one day, and she decided to rent it and came with us. And so we get there. My mother has rules for everything. She gets the first fish, the biggest fish, and the most fish. Other than that, you can fish. That's my mama's way to fish. Mama makes a job out of everything. She doesn't know how to have fun, so she makes a job out of everything. She takes the fun out of everything. She's your original party pooper. You know, we used to sing, every party needs a pooper. That's why we invited Pearl, party pooper, you know. So we're out there fishing, and I made a mistake. I caught the first fish. My mother took a look at it, and she says, it's not big enough to be a keeper. She rips it off my hook and throws it back in. I'm 5 years old. I've caught a fish. It's my fish. How dare her? I don't care. My philosophy of fishing, then and now, if it had eyes and a tail, string it. She hurt my feelings. So I go in this screaming coma right there in the boat. And Daddy tells me, honey, come out here in the back end of the boat with me. And as I get close to him, Daddy says, and we'll get her. Well, I don't know what it means, but intuitively I know I'm going to like it. And what it meant was every time she'd catch a fish, she'd swing around. He'd take the fish off, rebait her hook, she'd swing around, start fishing. And Daddy'd hand me the fish and I'd throw it over. Every fish the old heifer caught, I threw over. It was wonderful. Okay. Daddy was playing a joke on Mama. That's not what Mary Pearl learned. Mary Pearl learned, anytime anybody hurts you, do it back to him as many times as you can. And that's when I realized, when I was writing that down, that's where I learned revenge that day. And if I do not believe my daddy, under any circumstances, would set out to teach me revenge. But I love slow premeditated revenge. I always have, as far back as I could remember. Why? Because I got off on getting her, you know? And I wrote that down as my most pleasant childhood memory. See, an inventory is helpful. Because never before had I realized where that started and how that started. It was with Mama and the fish. And this revenge thing was going to go with me my whole life. Why wouldn't it? It works. You know, my next door neighbor hacked me off. This was after my first husband and I separated, and I was a party girl, and I love to go out and stay out, and I'm a night person, so I'd stay up all night, come home, about 7:30 in the morning, I'm ready to go to bed. Well, he has a little garden out in the back. He wants to till his garden. Do you know how loud a tiller is at that hour of the morning when you're trying to sleep? So I went out and explained that to him, and he told me to shut my mouth and get back in the house. He didn't know about Mama and the fish. I waited till 11:30 at night, and I got my daddy's Frog-Gillian headlight, and I mowed my grass. You know, who can play that game? Well, the sheriff came to see me. So you go into Plan B. Now, this guy had beagle dogs. Now, if you've ever had one beagle, you know they're barking little dogs. He had six of them, little beagles out there in the pen. And I'd wait till, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I would run off my back porch, and I'd run across the yard. I'd take a broom handle. I'd run up and down that dog yard fence, beating on that fence with that broom handle, and those dogs would go into a complete hysterical frenzy. I'd run, jump back on my porch, and he'd come out, and he'd be screaming at them, cussing at them. He'd be out there in his underwear, hosing them down to get them to shut up. He'd go back in the house. We'd wait an hour and do it one more time. The sheriff came to see me. There were several other things that we did, and then I decided I needed to sort of tone that down. The sheriff and I were developing a relationship. But I got off on that. I got off on thinking how to get even. You know, I mean, that was a fun thing with me. That was a thing. I was also a why person. Like I say, I'd use the why for management and how to manipulate people. And I also found that with the degree of anger and rage that I carried with me all the time, people were afraid of me, and it kept them off at a distance. Yet I wanted to be close to people. It was like in one hand I'm saying, come here, and then I'm saying, don't come. Come here, don't come. You know, I wanted the closeness, but I was afraid if you got too close, you would hurt me. And I didn't want the hurt. So I was always sending out the mixed messages. And then I had resentment and revenge nearly kill me. That resentment, that all-consuming hate that you have for someone else. You know, when I'd go to meetings I'd hear the open meetings, the alcoholics talking about having resentments, being the number one offender for people getting drunk again. I would thinking, resentment, you are such weenies. I don't resent, I hate. You know, resentment is such a mild thing, you know. And I realize it is an insidious thing that if you don't handle it, then you get the hate, you get the revenge. And in my case, I was more violent because of those things. And when you're violent, it has a tendency to keep people away from you. You'd be surprised that it always shocked me that people would be afraid to get me mad. Just don't get her mad, you know. She'll wreck the room. You just don't want to do that, you know. And then there was the violence in my own home. You know, my husband never raised a hand to me. I was the one that was the abuser in the home. When he would come home drunk, then instead I told him not to, so he had to be punished. That was just very, very simple. We had developed a mother-child relationship. My mother did not have the ability to deal with her anger. And so I was abused as a child, physically abused. And you know, the thing about it is, I was so sick for mother's attention. I would do things knowing she would beat the hell out of me, because at least while she was beating me, I had her undivided attention. And that shows you how sick that is, how very, very sick that is. And I also was very dishonest, even with myself, about things. And I tried to be things that I wasn't. At the company I worked for, I was in charge of all the sales, promotion, and advertising, and I was the assistant to the CEO. And one of my duties was to put on conventions and things of this nature, and we were having a retirement party out at the new country club. Now, there was the old money country club that we always had the Christmas party, but this was the new money country club in town, and I said, well, we'll have that out there. We've never done anything over there. So I made all these arrangements and everything, and the day of the big event, I had my hair was real long and black, and I had seen a picture on a movie magazine of Elizabeth Taylor where she had it pulled up with all these cascading curls coming, and I thought, well, my hair might do that, and so I went and had them do that, and then I went to Merle Norman and had them do me fancy makeup for the evening, and the girl suggested I put on false eyelashes. Now, I had never worn false eyelashes, and they put them on your finger, and you can't even feel them. You put them on your lid, and they weigh 10 pounds. I don't know. It just feels like they weigh. So now you've got these giant spiders on your face. And then my mother had made me this gown that I had designed out of blue velvet and chiffon, and had a high empire waist with the rhinestones all around it, and it was so pretty. And I got out there at the country club, and I had told JD before we left, I said, do not embarrass me. Do not get drunk and embarrass me out here at the country club. And he said, okay. So we get out there at the country club, and all of a sudden I look across the room, and there's a woman on that has a dress on just like mine. How can that be? I designed it, mother made it, how can that be? So I made an observation to some of the people at our table. I said, can you believe that? That woman has a dress, well, at least it looks better on me than it does on her. And I began, and they'd laugh, and we'd make all these comments. And later, it just got the better of me. I couldn't stand it. And so I walked across the room to find out. And as I walked across the room to meet her, she walked across the room to meet me. It was a mirror I had been looking in all day. You see, by having the hairdo and the eyelash, I didn't even recognize who I was. And all of my friends had been laughing and carrying on with me, and they knew. I just walked right on out, got in the car, and left. JD said, I'm not used to you leaving me like that. And I just couldn't go back in. It's like I go back to work, I've got to face them. And of course, I was the joke of the company, you know. And you see, I didn't know how to laugh at myself back then. Today, I'd think that was a stitch. But it didn't seem that way to me at the time, you know. But I love it. I love it. The thing about it is, if you can laugh at yourself, you can laugh with other people. And you know, that's what we learned in this program, that we laugh with one another, not at each other. You know, because we are alike. Maybe you didn't do your thing exactly like I did, but you know, that's just the way it is. There's another thing too, you know, I don't like for people to think that I'm nutty as a fruitcake, which I can be, but I try not to. And so JD was having a problem with one of the cats in the neighborhood. JD leaves his boots outside instead of bringing them in the house when he comes home from work, because he's a welder. And he doesn't want any of those shavings or anything to get in the carpet, which I appreciate. And all of a sudden, I noticed he started putting his boots on top of my car. On I have a station wagon. He kept putting them up on the top. And I said, why? And he says, because the cat was spraying them down there, and he figured maybe it wouldn't spray it up there. Okay. So one morning I get up and I'm running around doing all my errands in town, and I come back by the service station, I pump my gas, I go in, and the guy says, why have you got a pair of boots on top of your car? I hadn't even noticed them up there, you know, so as not to appear an idiot. I said, I'm airing them out. You know, don't appear to be an idiot. Let there be no doubt, you know. Open your mouth. There's no doubt. You know, just little things like this. Just little things. Okay, I think it's time to stop for lunch.